marking the UN's World Refugee Day, which was just last month. Tamara Sahib, Head of Communications for Médecins Sans Frontières, joins me today, Doctors Without Borders, to discuss the refugee plight and understand better what it's like to be an asylum seeker, to be remote from your home country, to be always in passage, in transition, and how that can impact the health and well-being of the individual, the family, and the wider community. So it's a real pleasure to welcome Tamara Sahib, Head of Communications, based at the regional branch office here in the UAE. Hello and welcome.
Hello, Suzanne. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me today. So, World Refugee Day is held every year on June the 20th. It's to commemorate the strength, courage and perseverance of millions of refugees. Now, this year, World Refugee Day also marks a key moment for the public to show support for families forced to flee. Give me an overview of, and it's a big topic, but to understand or give a sense of not only the role that Médecins Sans Frontières play when it comes to migration and refugees, but maybe also where we're at today, if we can put it into some kind of context.
Well, according to the latest estimates, we are talking today about having over 65 million forcibly displaced people. And when we're referring to these kind of people, these are people who have been driven out of their homes due to mainly wars, violence, persecution, and extreme poverty. And we need to understand what this means as well. When we're talking about forcibly displaced, one third of those people are actually people who have left their countries. And this is the term when we talk about refugees. Today we have about 22 million refugees. Okay, but two thirds of those people are also people who are internally displaced, i.e. they're still within their countries, but they're no longer, you know, they left their homes due to lack of security and safety. Just to give you a sense of the scale of the issue, we're almost talking about 20 people being forcibly displaced every minute. And 50% of the refugees today are people under the age of 18. And so what is the issue for us? Why we should be concerned is today, these kind of people, normally we should be able to provide them with protection, assist them, and allow them. They have the right to respect their right to seek asylum and a better place to live and a safer place to live. However, what we're seeing is that governments, particularly in Europe, are instead building fences and walls and focusing on signing agreements with countries that are basically focusing on border control management and security. So what does this actually mean? That means that when you're a desperate person running away from war, basically, and all the doors are closed, you're going to start taking dangerous routes. And this is what we've been talking and seeing every day on the news, is people crossing the Mediterranean Sea at their own risks and, you know, at the cost of their lives. The second thing and more important thing is that these people become extremely vulnerable to dire humanitarian and medical conditions, and they are vulnerable to being subject to violence that could be an abuse by smugglers, but also border and police authorities. And what it means to us as Médecins Sans Frontières, that we are depriving these people of their basic right of access to medical healthcare. And this is where we intervene.
And that's very much part of your mission with MSF. So humanitarian medical assistance to victims of conflict. It could be conflict, it could be natural disasters, epidemics, or healthcare exclusion. So this is where you come into play. This is not new. Refugees, through the ages, there are people in diaspora that are displaced. But looking at the UN action, a 1951 Refugee Convention and its 1967 Protocol, refugees are among the most vulnerable people in the world. The 1951 Refugee Convention and its 1967 Protocol help protect them. They are the only global legal instruments explicitly covering the most important aspects of a refugee's life. According to their provisions, refugees deserve, as a minimum, the same standards of treatment enjoyed by other foreign nationals in a given country, and in many cases, the same treatment as nationals. Now, that's just the beginning of a very, very long document, but it's just to highlight that that's from 1951, 1967, and the code and conduct continues today.
Yes, correct. I mean, as I said earlier, the problem is itself that we do have international conventions, international agreements by which all the countries signatory to these agreements should provide, as you said, a minimum standard of humane and dignified treatment to these refugees. And what we're seeing is that actually they are not being implemented. As I said, out of fear, there's a priority focused on security and managing these people and pushing them even away instead of providing them with the medical and healthcare needs. Throughout their journey, there's two parts, when they go through that journey, but also when they are received and hosted.
We're going to be exploring the word vulnerable as well. Vulnerability, what does that mean to a human being? And we're going to be looking at a report as well coming from Médecins Sans Frontières, so rather timely. World Refugee Day was on June the 20th. This report's just come out this month, a dramatic deterioration for asylum seekers on Lesbos in Greece. We're going to be going through this report. It's certainly made my eyebrows raise this morning on some of the things that I've learned from the report about the human condition and what people are going through. And if we look, take a look at World Refugee Day and have a listen here now, this is the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
What is it like to flee war, disasters or persecution? To leave everything behind? More people than ever in our lifetimes are living this nightmare. And their stories are heartbreaking. Hardship, separation, death. I've met so many who have lost so much, but they never lose their dreams for their children or their desire to better our world. They ask for little in return, only our support in their time of greatest need, and our solidarity. And it is so inspiring to see countries with the least often doing the most for refugees. On World Refugee Day, we reflect on the courage of those who have fled and the compassion of those who welcome them. It has resolved to re-establish the integrity of the international refugee protection regime. And let us work to give everyone the chance to build a better future together.
So listening there to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, UN Refugee Agency launched the hashtag With Refugees, petitioning in June 2016 to send a message to governments that they must work together and do their fair share for refugees. Getting an insight into life as a refugee with Head of Communications for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, based here at the regional office in the UAE. She is Tamara Sahib. And Tamara, I want to share a clip here where I was marking World Refugee Day, when we're talking about understanding some of the pathways and routes and journeys refugees may go on, but also the challenges they're facing when it comes to their health. Well-being seems like a light word, but seriously, their health and well-being. Have a listen to this.
The fuel canister on your rubber dinghy has been leaking since last night. Now you're sitting in a toxic mixture of salt water and gasoline. Your skin is burning. It's excruciating, like someone is running a vegetable peeler across your thighs. But you can't move. You are one of 100 people on board a boat built to hold 30. No matter how hard you scream or squirm, you're trapped.
There is a big wooden boat and it's tipping over.
The fumes make you dizzy. The dehydration is getting worse, and the gasoline melts your skin. You're about ready to throw yourself into the sea. Anything to stop the pain.
So MSF treat aboard, you know, people trying to make their passage across the sea, Mediterranean, wherever it may be, on boats. Search and rescue vessels are there, and fuel burns are one of the most common injuries MSF doctors would treat.
Yes, I mean, most of the medical issues that we'll talk about today is a complete reflection and mirror of the refugees' journey. As you said, in that case, from the moment they take these rubber boats and the moment we take them on board and we rescue and assist them, the main pathologies that we see is, as you've heard, fuel burns, also skin diseases, hydration, hypothermia. These are some of the main things that we see when we take them after they've spent 4 to 5 days in the sea, knowing again from the beginning that from the moment they take that boat, they are doomed to die because it's not equipped to cross the Mediterranean Sea. And also what we see that 1 out of 10 women that we rescue from these boats are pregnant, and we've had deliveries on our boats. That's also only, we're talking only about the physical conditions that we see, not talking about the traumatic, the mental health aspect of it, where we also see a lot of post-traumatic stress disorders that we'll need to cater to as soon as we onboard them on our boats.
You've given us some figures, quite large figures, of what it means in the sense of, you know, defining refugee. And as you said, whether it's displaced within home country or migration outside of home country. But what are some of those migration routes, and what are some of the countries you're seeing the most when it comes to refugees?
Okay, like we said, since the EU-Turkey deal and the closure of the Idomeni and the Balkan routes, so of course there's the Mediterranean Sea that starts from Libya. This is why we have these vessels on international waters closest possible to the Libyan waters, and they are offloaded mainly in the Italian ports, Sicily in particular. So this is a first point of reception. So this is where, as I said, as soon as we provide them with the assistance needed on the boats, one of the first aspects we provide is, for example, psychological first aid. And this is where these people are received in different types of centers. And this is why I was saying the kind of medical issues we see is a reflection of where they're hosted, the conditions in which they're hosted.
So give me an example of that.
So as I said, if we take Italy, but also in Greece, most of these centers are temporary emergency centers. They are informal shelters. There are places that are open airspace, which means there are tents open, which they don't have the proper hygiene and sanitation conditions. And also there are places where people are not segregated. If we take, for example, the recent report you mentioned in Lesbos, in Greece, they have over 60,000 migrants and asylum seekers that are divided between mainland and the islands. Today, the islands, like the island of Lesbos, are taking double the capacity that they can. We're talking about almost 14,000 people. So if you're a man with your wife and your kids and you arrive to that island, okay, you are thrown into a camp or a shelter, informal shelter, with 200 other people. As I said, it's open space. You're sleeping on concrete floor. There's no segregation between women, men, and children. So you can imagine the kind of living, hosting conditions in which they are in. They will be extremely vulnerable to the kind of diseases and medical issues that we're seeing. And of course, these people come already either with, you know, chronic diseases, either they come, as we saw in the report, where they have been, you know, subject to violence or torture. These are sort of the conditions in which they arrive and where they're hosted. And as we were talking about policies and how policies directly impact the medical conditions and the living conditions they're living in Lesbos in particular, our worry today is that there have been a lot of changes in policies in May and June. Basically, what happens, we talked about vulnerable people. If you are supposed to, when you arrive, be identified and medically screened as a first step, and then based on your medical screening, be subject to a vulnerability screening. These are people who have medical issues and conditions that needs to be fast-tracked for their right to seek asylum and moved from the island to the mainland to have access to proper medical care. What is happening today is that policies have been changed. Now there's not this fast-track system. People have to stay on the island to have their first asylum interview. And what is happening today is because they have less resources, less people doing these medical screenings, less people doing these vulnerability screenings, you can sit up to 3 months living in these conditions to get your right to be screened and then get proper access to move to the mainland.
Why are there less people there? Why are there less people helping or being able to assist with that screening process?
Because today, as I said, policy, they are, the European Union and the authorities and the Greek authorities are afraid of creating a pull factor and allowing all these people immediately to come to the mainland. And there are other NGOs working with whom we also work, like Médecins du Monde and the Hellenic Red Cross. But unfortunately, even they are scaling down in terms of their resources. So today, what is needed is more people to be able to provide medical screenings and vulnerability screenings for these people.
Well, here's an example. So a 48-year-old man from Afghanistan is at the Moria camp in Lesbos. This was the 20th of June of this year. We arrived 5 days ago on Lesbos Island and the authorities brought us to Moria camp. They put us under a big plastic shelter, which is nothing else except a hard surface. After 3 days, the authorities registered us without a medical screening. They didn't even ask us if we needed to see a doctor or not. We have people with serious medical issues in our family. I have rheumatism and cardiovascular problems, and my sons have psychiatric issues. They take tranquilizers and I take medicine too. We finished our medicines. After the registration, the authorities moved us to Section A in a big room where where more than 30 people from Afghanistan and Iran are staying, men, women and children together. Many of us have serious medical issues and the whole night nobody can sleep. Even during the day, nobody can rest. The lights are on the whole night and I can't stay here with the lights on during the night in this camp. We don't know what they will do with us and what will happen to us.
Yeah. I mean, the numbers we've seen in this report, at least based on what the kind of patients MSF is treating and dealing and assisting with, is from between April and June, these numbers have quadrupled. So on one hand, you have numbers increasing, and on the other hand, you have policies trying to slow down the process. And in terms of our assessments, 80% of the mental health assessments we've done can be categorized as severe. And you have half of the women that we've screened between Jan and June that we've, you know, assessed have been subject to sexual violence. All these cases of torture, violence, and severe cases of mental health fall into the category of vulnerability. Yet today, the data shows us that less than 30% of these cases that are supposed to be vulnerable haven't been even identified.
Yeah, so, you know, you don't, you know, if you're looking at what that word means, vulnerable, there's more there that haven't been assessed. When you're looking at the report from MSF, when it comes to the increasing numbers, deteriorating situation in Lesbos, Greece, as an example, this report's just come out this month. Of the 154 patients assessed in our mental health program between the 1st of January and mid-June, at least two-thirds reported having experienced violence before coming to Greece, many having experienced multiple forms of violence in their home country, along the journey and in Greece as well. Just to get that in perspective there. So violence happening, and this in this case with women, almost half of the 245 women who came to our clinic for gynecological consultations in that time frame, January to mid-June, had been victims of sexual violence, a third of which were violated in their country of origin and two-thirds during their journey.
As I said initially, yes, that's the whole issue when we're talking about vulnerability, is that these people are much more likely to be subject to violence, again, by smugglers, police, border authorities. And we're not only seeing it in the context of Greece and Lesbos. In Serbia, for example, also where also we provide support, 800 of the patients that we've received, first of all, are young and underage. They live in abandoned buildings. And what was worrying for us is what we're getting. Last year, we had 56 trauma cases. They are mainly due to beating, robberies, incarcerations. It's not about just treating open wounds, but swollen limbs and cracks. So this is a reality that we need to cater to, and we cannot process these cases and provide them with the necessary medical aid if there are no resources in place to do the proper medical screenings.
We'll hear more about the plight. It's not a pleasant story, but you mentioned it there. It's reality. It's a real story and a real plight for individuals. And if we're looking at humanity and understanding what's really going on and maybe how we can help, or at least be aware of fellow human beings and what they're going through on a day-to-day basis, I mean, what does it say about us, I suppose, each individual? Understanding better the plight of refugees in the world, marking World Refugee Day. It was last month, June the 20th. The UN highlights the day each year, and I'm talking in conversation with Tamara Sahib, who is Head of Communications for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. She's based here in the regional branch office of the UAE, and yes, Doctors Without Borders doing amazing work across the globe when it comes to humanity humanity when it comes to natural disasters, people divided by war, people that have been blighted by famine, whatever it may be. That is the role, to go in there without judgment, without being political, but to go and fulfill their role as medical professionals. We are focusing today on refugees and the plight. And Tamara, you've already been sharing some of the figures and statistics. I think in light of this report that's just come out regarding Lesbos in Greece, and seeing there the increase of numbers of people seeking asylum, arriving there already in a pretty vulnerable state, whether it's been through torture, whether it's been through sexual abuse, violence, whether it's just through pre-existing medical conditions that need treating or continue to need being treated through medication. But they have to go through a long process waiting to go through the assessment to see how vulnerable they are, to understand whether they can seek asylum or not, as the case may be. Have a listen to this. I'm going to share just a little piece. It's from a gentleman speaking in his native tongue.
ما كنت لا ضد النظام ولا مع ضد المعارضة ولا ضد أي حزب. أنا بحالي بشغلي وأدير عبالي على أمي وأبوي وبس. مسكوني كنت جاي من لبنان على الشام وحطوني بالسجن سنة وثمان شهور. التعذيب.
Now that's Khalil, who was wrongly accused and imprisoned in Syria by the regime. Tell me more of his story.
So basically, this is one of many cases where, again, we receive patients that have been subject to torture in their home nations, wrongly accused, as you mentioned, imprisoned for a year and 8 months, and then basically managed to escape via Lebanon. So these are the kind of cases where he came with, unfortunately, lesions in his legs. Today, where he needed both physical, of course, rehabilitation and treatment, we had, unfortunately, to amputate some of his toes, but also, of course, there's the psychological support that is provided. In Khalil's case, luckily, this is someone who still had hope, because in most cases, what we also see is that most of the victims of torture arrive with a lot of anxiety, depression, but also suicidal thoughts and attempts. They don't want to continue their lives. So these are sorts of the cases where MSF intervenes, not in terms of just an emergency mode, you know, about treating wounds or providing
sort of a reactive response.
Yeah. Where you need a longer term response. So, for example, in Greece, both in Greece and Italy, we've set up, in collaboration with local NGOs, you know, centers for torture victims, where we use a multidisciplinary approach that provides both the physical, psychiatric, as well as social and legal support and facilitation for them. And that allows them to stay longer periods than, you know, just on the spot kind of emergency response. And it goes beyond, as I said, our traditional sort of emergency care that we provide to refugees.
How many doctors do you have on the ground? Can you give us an idea, you know?
I think that would be very difficult, because, as you said, we follow the journey of the refugees. So we're talking, you know, whether it's on the vessels and the sea and Italy and Greece and Serbia. So we're talking about thousands. And that's not counting also the kind of support we provide refugees in the hosting countries, in Turkey, Lebanon and Jordan. So
what about the existing medical teams within that country? You know, so medical staff that are local to, say, Lesbos or wherever it may be in Europe. Do you work alongside? Are they working as well with the refugees? Is it always down to the NGOs?
No, I mean, the way Médecins Sans Frontières works usually is really about having its own teams on the ground to do the independently, as you said earlier, the assessments and providing directly the medical care. And when we talk about our staff, there are, of course, expats, but a lot of the national staff. So, for example, I was talking about that medic project in Greece that we do with the Babel Day Center and the Greek Council for Refugees. And this is where, for example, we receive up to, you know, we have teams, a mix of teams between psychologists, you know, medical doctors, also important, very important cultural mediators and translators. We offer that within our own services, but also within the public hospitals in places like in Greece or in Italy, where we provide support to patients.
Is there like a sort of central control for MSF in the sense that, you know, if you see something coming, or if there is an emergency like a natural disaster in a country, how does the operational side of it work? How much time can you be able to respond and be in a certain country to offer support?
MSF actually distinguishes itself by the speed of its response, because again, our specialization unlike other, for example, UN organization, is emergency response, which means being able to deploy ourselves within 48 to 72 hours. Of course, in some cases, like in natural disasters, if we're already in country, that means that we can even respond faster than, you know, within the 24 hours. The other element that allows us to respond very fast beyond our logistical, that's the other part. People think of us as just a medical organization, but we have a very strong and well-developed logistical response, is the fact that we're independently financed, which means that we have this pool of money there. Whenever there's an emergency, we don't need to wait for the money to come and help us deploy our resources. Over 92% of our funds come from individuals like you and me. So that we're, you know, more than 40 years old. We have, you know, medical and logisticians that whenever there's a crisis, we go in. As I said, it's very important for us to do this independent assessment, because we need to ensure that we go to places where people are in need of us, and there's no other people like other NGOs actually responding to that issue.
And who are the doctors? I mean, Médecins Sans Frontières originates in France. It was a group of doctors that wanted to make a difference and play their part in helping people. But, you know, it's not like it's a regular team of doctors going around the world. They're also working in their own countries in hospitals and clinics.
Exactly. I like always to remind people that actually when we were founded by a group of both journalists and doctors, because part of our role as well is always to speak on behalf of our patients. It was very important for us to stay outside the politics and be impartial and independent and neutral. And it was originated in France, but today we have 5 operational centers, again, as I said, because we needed to expand that logistical support and deployment of doctors across 5 different operational centers. And as you said, when we go in, we have that speed of the doctors. 80% actually of our doctors are actually national doctors, and the other 20% are represented by what we call international volunteers. So these are, like you said correctly, people, and I think you met recently with one of them, Dr. Javed, is they can have their own, you know, private practices, but also would devote their time and their skill set and their competence to work with us on emergency missions.
And I think I said this to Dr. Javed, but, you know, how are they cared for in a situation? You know, if they're going in every day and say they're in Lesbos in Greece and they're seeing increasing numbers, people that are sitting in these makeshift shelters and they've been there maybe for weeks and they've still not gone through their process yet to know if they've got asylum, they've got medical conditions, you're going into those sort of conditions as a doctor, you know, how are they treating them and how do they deal and cope with what they have to take away with them, their own sort of post-traumatic stress even?
So in terms of us dealing with the patients, well, like I said, I think beyond the primary objective of saving their lives and caring to their immediate medical needs, it's really our aim is to give them a sense of hope and dignity back based on what we've seen them treating. And that's what I said, psychological, psychiatrist, cultural mediation, all is part of the kind of support we provide. For our own doctors, I think Dr. Javed already said it, where are we also working? Even our own doctors have, you know, consultations. So normally after they go on their missions, they are also have access to the kind of, you know, individual and group sessions that are needed to support them in their work and be able to deal with everything that they've seen on the ground.
Well, we mentioned their post-traumatic stress disorder. Have a listen to somebody's account of what they've gone through as a refugee in their journey dealing with PTSD.
You were forced to flee your home, leaving your community, your family, your life behind. Who can say what you saw and experienced on your journey? The trauma, both physical and mental, has left you with post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, you relive your ordeal through flashbacks and hallucinations, You struggle to sleep, and when you do, you're often haunted by nightmares of what you have lived through. People make you irritable or angry, and you don't know why. More and more, you withdraw from the world around you, feeling alienated and avoiding people, unable to relate to them.
Well, according to the UN, just stating here, in a world where violence forces thousands of families to flee for their lives each day, the time is now to show that the global public stands with refugees. Well, do you agree? Some people will say that actually we already have enough of problems in our own country to deal with other people coming into our country. What do you say? And when it comes to the humanitarian side of things, how can this situation be improved? How can people's lives? We started at the top of the show regarding sort of basic needs of a human being and how that's defined when it comes to, you know, food, water, health. If that's not happening to a human being, what does that say? What do we do about that? Teams from Médecins Sans Frontières, they provide medical, psychological and social support to people cut off from health services. I'm just looking here at the 2015 MSF report and activities at a glance. So over 8 million outpatient consultations. You've got over 219,000 births assisted. Alongside that, migrants, refugees rescued and assisted at sea, 23,000 over that number. HIV patients, also huge numbers there. Patients admitted to malnutrition programs, over 60,000. So those numbers increase. So 2015, MSF had 450 projects in 69 countries in addition to search and rescue operations. We've been focusing today on refugees, the plight of refugees, what it means to be vulnerable, and understanding that word as they are assessed and the journey that refugees go on. Talking to Tamara Sahib, who's head of communications for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. Tremendous work is being done. We wish we didn't need you, really, but the truth is we do.
Thank you. And I think also we need you, more importantly. And when I say you, everyone, as an individual, as an NGO, as authorities, as I said, I think I used a lot of numbers today, but it goes back to the individuals. Remember those stories we heard? These are people like you and me. And what we need today is number one thing is to stop pushing these people into danger and have policies that provide them with safe passage, a way to cross the borders and to apply for asylum in a fair and equitable and an efficient way, and respect their rights to seek safety. Mm. If we start by doing that, then, you know, a lot of the medical issues we've been talking all throughout about would be, you know, solved.
A lot less. Absolutely.
To a certain degree.
I mean, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I think you're right. I think that what you've highlighted more today, more than ever, is that, yes, there are huge problems happening in certain countries, and there are wars, and there's deprivation for the, you know, the innocent people that are caught up in it, the people that live there that are caught up in it. And sometimes it's easy for us to just think it when we see numbers and we see the idea of refugees moving into different countries. But they're not on a jolly. This has not been this. And that's what's really been highlighted to me and looking through the report as well. And you can check these out for yourselves online on the MSF website as well. You get a real sense of, as a human being, what people, literally the ends of earth, they will go to try and survive and take care of their families and children as well. As you mentioned before, it's younger people as well as the older generations trying to find some place of safety. And they're not necessarily asking for a lot, but what they are asking for is that protection, safety and basic needs, as we highlighted before, water, food and healthcare.
Correct. As I said, at the end of the day, when you think of the world we live in, the technology, we're in the 21st century, and that is supposed to bring us closer, we're going back to the basics. When people tell us, why are you saving people in the sea? If you're seeing someone, a child or a mother dying in front of you, you're not going to just sit there and stand. You're going to reach out with your hand. And that's what we're asking you. And every one of us, even if I know this is maybe sounds talk, think it's a drop in the ocean, but it matters. Yeah. For each of one to try to do something about it.
We can get overwhelmed, you know, because of, you know, and I'm part of this picture, you know, technology, media, it's a great tool, it's a great thing, it's a way of bringing information. So we get more information today than we ever have done. Great. However, the flip side of that is we've now got so much information, we're overwhelmed by it and we don't know where to go or what to how to prioritise that information. So it's really important for people to just take a little bit of time to think about it and to their own due diligence, do their own research, find the truth that's the truth for you and marries to your value system, I suppose, if you want to align yourself with a particular cause or you're just interested to find out more.
Yes, I mean, and just remember yourself, your own case. You're living, and we're lucky where we're living today. When you're sick and you go to the hospital, how would you like to be treated when you go into that hospital, without regards to your economic status, your religion, your, you know, political position? This is what we do every day in very extreme cases. And again, we're appreciative of what you and anyone else, supporting us, whether by talking about the issues, by, you know, calling upon the authorities to do something, or even by supporting us.
And your journey with MSF, and also, you know, with the causes around the world, tell me why you chose to work in this field.
Well, I'm originally Syrian, my father, I actually, you know, I know it sounds idealistic to say we all want to make a difference, that kind of work in particular, when you're so close to the ground, you can really actually see the difference you made. I sometimes compare it to the farmer who's, you know, you seed and you see the land and you see it grow. It is a good time in terms of investment, and there are such a growing need that I hope a lot of more people are driven by that kind of, you know, it's motivating, it drives you constantly despite all the obstacles that you see. And that's what I was looking for, and this is what I'm lucky to provide and have.
And, you know, it's not all doom and gloom, you know, because what comes with humanity, with pain is pleasure and joy and sadness, and it's a part of life. And when, you know, those people do get through and do get to a place, yes, of settlement, of safety, that's incredibly rewarding to know that they've, I know it doesn't end, because it's not all easy, even when you've got placed and you are finding asylum, you know, there are other issues that can come up and it can take many years to recover. But at least you're out of immediate danger, one hopes.
Yes, the journey, that's the most important point that people need to remember, that the journey is not just about crossing the sea, crossing the borders. And even when you arrive in places like France and Germany or Sweden, we're talking about long-term scars, long-term issues that we need to help, not just even on a medical point of view, but also from an educational point of view, etc. So this is why there are other organizations catering to that. And like you said correctly, at the end of the day, suffices, like I think Dr. Javid expressed it, when you're a doctor and you receive a letter 10 months down the road of someone telling you, thank you for giving us a chance to live in a dignified and a safe manner, that means something to us.
Thank you very much for sparing time to talk to us today, marking World Refugee Day with Medicine Sans Frontières. That is Doctors Without Borders. We've been talking to Tamara Saheb, who is Head of Communications based here in the UAE at the regional branch. Check out online, find out more information about what MSF do. For now, thank you very much for your time, Tamara.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.